Coming up on Weekend America.
What a difference a weekend makes.
I was taking a 6-mile run in the sunshine and, you know, having a lovely fish dinner with my boyfriend, and it is a really, really different story this weekend.
That's because she's in central China right now aiding earthquake victims. We'll hear more from that later. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. When you strum an ancient Iraqi instrument, you get more than a beautiful sound.
The great things about the oud that when you play it in the oud, you have to hug it. It goes directly to your heart.
We'll visit one of the world's best oud players. He's performing in Santa Fe this weekend. And later, a Texas hip-hop duo always dreamed of making it big.
Come from a small town, you know what I'm saying? And there were times when we weren't making any money from what we were doing, but we were still trying to move forward, and people didn't understand that.
But only one of them lived to see the day. On Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Berkeley, California knows what you think of it. This weekend, the town is celebrating its radical reputation with a tribute to Berkeley firsts, innovations that seemed out there at the time, and now they're in there. They make a whole lot of sense. We'll take you to Berserkly in just a few minutes. What are you doing this weekend?
Probably working all weekend, quite a few different jobs. I feel all right because it's all to help pay for my wedding, which is going to be awesome.
I am going to be doing some volunteering to protect whales.
First come to work, hopefully I get off early so I can come out here and see the fine women.
Well, this weekend, actually, I have a party planned, and I even got the Evite out there. We've got everything all set.
Horse racing / ostrich racing.
I didn't know that they raced ostriches at the Preakness, too.
Yes, it's a preliminary event. Those voices came to us from Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, Bill, this weekend we've all been haunted by other voices, voices from Asia, where natural disasters have wreaked total havoc. The death toll from the cyclone in Myanmar just keeps rising. And meanwhile, people in China are reeling from Monday's earthquake that hit a 7.9 on the Richter scale. This weekend, Joy Portella, a Seattle native, is in Sichuan Province, the hardest hit area. She arrived on Thursday, and she's been working with a relief organization called Mercy Corps. She took a break from the efforts to talk to us from her hotel in China. Joy, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Joy, compare your last weekend in Seattle with the weekend you're having now.
Well, I can tell you last weekend was not exactly a dream weekend either, because we are also responding to the cyclone in Myanmar. Though that has been a much slower response to pick up because it's been so challenging to get people in there. But we were responding and already had that one huge human tragedy kind of weighing on us. But other than that, I was taking a 6-mile run in the sunshine and, you know, having a lovely fish dinner with my boyfriend and relaxing on my deck. And it is a really, really different story this weekend.
What have you seen so far?
It's pretty bleak, of course, depending on where you are. And, you know, lots of homelessness. There were over 4 million homes that were damaged. Lots of, you know, people living out in the middle of the street, no access to water, no access to food. So that's a, you know, that's a grim situation. I think the most touching thing I heard was actually from a reporter I was talking to today, who said that they had gone out at one of the, unfortunately, many schools that collapsed here. And they were talking to parents and just were struck by these parents who were waiting around the school to basically have the bodies of their children dug out. So really, their whole families had been taken down by this.
Have you ever been in a disaster area like this?
No, I haven't. I've been in some other, what I'll call interesting situations with Mercy Corps, but not an area immediately post-disaster. And it's really a different kind of animal.
How did you prepare yourself to deal with what you might encounter there?
Well, I didn't have a lot of time because, you know, these things happen quickly and you get on a plane and you do it. But it is a 12-hour plane ride from the East Coast. So, you know, it's half kind of convincing yourself that this is your job and this is what you have to do. And then on a human level of the tragedy and kind of steeling yourself to see things that, frankly, people shouldn't have to see, but you do.
Joy, why are you there? I mean, there are plenty of people who've been watching and many of us feel helpless and many are writing checks or donating mm-hmm. things. You got on a plane and went there. Why?
You know, this is what I've chosen to do for a living. This is why people work for aid organizations, because they feel compelled to do something firsthand for people in need. And they feel like that should be more than a spare time thing, which, by the way, I don't think this works for everyone, but you feel like that's what you should be doing for a living.
When you encounter a disaster of this magnitude, do you feel like you can really do something, or does it feel like sort of a drop in the bucket?
Well, I think with any big global problem, you know, not even disasters, your first impulse is to say, whoa, that is an enormous problem, and it seems like an intractable problem, and I can't really do anything about it. I know why that's the first impulse people have, because these problems are huge and they're overwhelming. But, you know, when you're out in the field and you see food getting out to people who wouldn't otherwise have it, children who are, you know, being counseled post-trauma, who are drawn out of their shells, even if it's one kid, you know, that makes a huge difference.
Well, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, Desiree.
That was Seattle native Joy Portela. She was speaking to us from her hotel in central China, where she's working this weekend to provide relief for China's earthquake victims.
This is the radio show about this American weekend. This weekend, California gays and lesbians are setting their wedding dates. The California Supreme Court ruled this week that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry. Now, of course, there's a whole history that led up to that decision, but you can trace at least one of the roots all the way back to an ordinance passed by the Berkeley City Council in 1984. Berkeley was the nation's first city to provide health benefits for domestic partners of local government employees. Now that ordinance is a model for cities around the country. Those are just the sort of links that a new exhibit at the Berkeley History Center is celebrating. It's called Berkeley, a City of Firsts. And Weekend America's Chrissy Clark takes us there.
Berkeley can be one of those cities that the rest of America loves to mock. Take this recent example from Fox News, when the network gleefully reported on a group of pagan witches protesting the Iraq War.
They are now casting spells for peace. Of course, you know where they are. Berkeley, California.
Or Berserkly, California, as it's known in some parts.
Berserkly, People's Republic of Berkeley. And they also say, well, only in Berkeley.
Linda Rosen, a proud Berkeleyite herself, has displayed these nicknames she wants to debunk, in giant letters at the front of the exhibit she's curated. Beneath them, it says, Berkeley, a city of firsts. Rosen is out to prove that the rest of America actually owes a lot to Berkeley's pioneering spirit.
This is a picture of the police department, a little after 1908, I think, and they are so proud of themselves.
Berkeley, known more for innovations in civil disobedience, was also an innovator in law enforcement.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Exhibit A, the lie detector. dreamed up in Berkeley in 1921 by the city police chief. He also established America's first police academy and recruited the first college-educated cops.
And everyone laughed and laughed at him, you know, college cops, for heaven's sakes. The media made fun of him.
Now it's commonplace around the country. Berkeley also claims to be home to the nation's first gourmet coffee shop, opened by Alfred Peet in 1966, the first crossing guard program, first municipal off-leash dog park, first power tool lending library, and the pickle. Actually, not the pickle. But Linda Rosen agrees that it's easy to go overboard. She's had to correct a few displays herself since the show opened a few weeks ago. Turns out Berkeley was not the first to put curb cuts in sidewalks for the disabled.
After Kalamazoo.
Or to invent curbside recycling.
We can now make beer in California.
But Berkeley's innovations in beer law, those are secure, as this song points out. It celebrates the country's first bill to legalize home brewing in 1978, thanks to a Berkeley-based lawmaker named Tom Bates. A national craze over micro brew pubs was born.
I actually just told them that they should put my picture like Colonel Sanders up on them, but nobody has done that.
Bates is now the mayor of Berkeley, and he says, sure, the Berkeley Firsts exhibit may feed into his city's occasional tendency towards self-importance, but it does something else, too.
People say, oh, gee, that's Berkeley. There they go again. Well, guess what? And, you know, you'll follow those trends, and those ideas travel, and they have legs, and eventually other people say, well, that's not such a screwy idea. Maybe we can do it.
In other words, watch out, Wichita, because in a few years, you too might have a ban on styrofoam, health benefits for domestic partners, and a surplus of gourmet dog bakeries.
Steiner.
I figured I should let someone in Middle America know about their impending future. So I called up Brint's Diner in Wichita, Kansas. Wichita already has a history of following in Berkeley's footsteps. They have a police academy and a tool lending library. But is Wichita ready for California cuisine? I ask the owner, Jesse Medina, who's about to sit down to a bacon cheeseburger with fried liver and onions.
No, I probably would if I had the clientele for it, but everybody's greased down here.
I tell Medina about Berkeley's plans to make it easier for families to switch to solar power. He likes it. As for the pagan witch anti-war protests?
I don't think that would happen here.
Why not?
Well, my early customers, we have time to talk, so we do talk politics. And they get, sometimes they'll start trembling.
Really?
The other guy starts sneezing. He can't stop sneezing.
Sneezing?
Yeah, he gets so upset that he'll start sneezing and he can't stop.
Medina says he visited Berkeley once. He missed Wichita pretty quickly. Though he did like listening to the hippies play guitar on Telegraph Avenue. In Berkeley, California, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
The show Berkeley, a City of Firsts, runs at the Berkeley History Center through the end of September.
Now, the other Berkeley firsts that you might be interested in, Berkeley was the home to the first listener-supported radio station, KPFA. Now, wasn't that a great idea?
Genius. Some of Berkeley's firsts, though, maybe not so great. Berkeley is thought to be the home of the first ever dirigible crash in 1908. The dirigible was fueled by gas from the gas main. It got up about 350 feet before it came back down. Some injuries, but everybody survived. And you can see that very precarious-looking beast and other Berkeley firsts at weekendamerica.org.
And all my neighbors thought so, too.
We can now make beer in California.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, a story about why it's better to give than receive. It's not like you have to give a pint of blood or anything. Well, maybe a pint or two. Or three. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Now, Bill, I don't know about you, but I live and die by my to-do list, especially on the weekends.
Yeah?
Yeah, it just helps me blaze through all the errands and chores, and then if I'm lucky, I can relax a bit on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, even when I want to relax, I can't, because I can get this nagging feeling that I'm still forgetting something, like picking up a birthday cake or filling a prescription. And it can be really bad when I have this inkling that I've made a promise to somebody and I just can't remember what it was. Ask our producer, Mark Sanchez. He made a big promise years ago, and then he forgot all about it. Here's what happened next.
I went out to get the paper a few months ago, and there was a FedEx package sticking out of the mailbox. It was one of those special before 10 in the morning deliveries. I figured they must have the wrong address. But when I saw the return address, I knew. I took the envelope inside and tossed it on the table. Maybe I'd open it after I got home from work. How did they track me down? I signed up with them like 5 years ago. I think I've moved 3 times since then. I didn't let it get to me, though. I didn't think about the envelope all day. But there it was, waiting for me on the table when I got home.
Dear Mark, thank you for participating in the National Marrow Donor Program, the NMDP. You recently have been identified as a potential match for a 43-year-old man in need of a life-saving bone marrow or blood stem cell transplant. We have been trying to contact you to arrange for confirmatory testing.
About 5 years ago, my cousin Scott was battling Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was getting ready for another round of chemo, and I felt pretty helpless. But what could I do for him? I planned to see him at the hospital, but I put it off for a couple days, and when I finally showed up, a nurse told me that he'd been moved to another hospital. While I was there, she asked me if I wanted to take a test to see if I qualified to be a bone marrow donor for Scott. As a family member, the odds were better that my cells would be a match for him. So she took a blood sample, and I found myself signing up to be part of the National Marrow Donor Program. Basically, if I wasn't a match for Scott, I might be a match for someone else down the road. It didn't seem like much, but I felt like I was helping. I wasn't a match. Scott died not too long after.
We understand that personal situations arise which make continued participation in this program difficult. Therefore, donors may elect to withdraw from this program at any time, either temporarily or permanently.
I tried to forget about the letter, but they wouldn't let me. The NMDP called me at home and at work, but I never answered the phone. It's not that I didn't care about the 43-year-old man, but it was like 5 years ago that I signed up. Being a donor just wasn't on my schedule anymore. I was feeling a little guilty. A friend reminded me that the letter said I was a potential match, and so it wasn't a done deal. In fact, being an exact match was probably a long shot. Perfect. I could go in, get tested, prove to them that my blood wasn't a match, and then my phone would stop ringing and I could walk away guilt-free. So I made the appointment. The nurse drew a little blood, thanked me, and I went on my way. A couple days later, the phone rang. I am a genetic twin of the 43-year-old man.
Hi. Hey. Are you the bone marrow transplant
yes.
clinic? Okay. I'm here for a physical.
What's your name?
Mark Sanchez.
As part of the deal, I had to get a physical. I hadn't been to the doctor in a long time, and I was secretly hoping they might find something wrong with me so I could back out of this. The physical was in the bone marrow transplant clinic. The waiting room was pretty crowded, but it was easy to spot the cancer patients. They were the ones wearing masks. They were there for their chemotherapy. I didn't make eye contact with anyone, and I tried to keep to myself in the waiting room. I kind of felt like an intruder. Then a nurse called my name. I took a deep breath and walked in.
All right. So this is probably the most blood you'll have drawn in one sitting in your whole life.
She had 11 tubes there, each with a color-coded rubber cap, all waiting for my blood.
It's less than 100 cc's of blood. So you're probably going to have a total of maybe 3 ounces.
A cardiogram, an EKG, and 3 ounces of blood later, and I'm good to go. Cleared for donation. Backache, sore sternum, a touch of insomnia.
One of the major side effects of this is pain.
That's Deb. She's the nurse that came by my house every day to give me shots. The shots stimulate cell growth in my bones, and then the cells are pushed out into my bloodstream. Ready for harvesting. I was prescribed a steady diet of Tylenol and ibuprofen to stay ahead of the pain.
I think this is a really wonderful thing you're doing.
People keep telling me this, but it's embarrassing. I don't like being in the spotlight, especially for something I was originally trying to get out of doing.
But you had to sign up for it. I mean,
Yeah.
A lot of people wouldn't do that because of going through all this.
Well, it doesn't seem that bad, you know? I mean, maybe the shot in the stomach will change my mind, but... Donation day arrives. One last shot to give my white blood cells a jolt.
So we're going to do a double arm. One will be on this side. It will constantly draw your blood.
They stick a needle in my right arm, and blood gets pulled into a centrifuge. That spins out the stem cells. Then the rest of the blood, the stuff that isn't the stem cells, it's pumped back into my left arm.
And, you know, if you need anything, like if you need to eat or you're hungry or you're thirsty, just let me know.
Thank God my wife was there. I'm on this reclining chair with my arms splayed out for like 6.5 hours. 6.5 hours, and I can't move. Anytime I had an itch, she had to scratch it for me. And anytime I wanted something to eat, she had to feed it to me. And anytime I had to go to the bathroom, she was there with the pan.
So you're free.
I'm free.
You got both your arms back.
All right. Before I knew it, we were done.
Make sure you move so slow, very slowly.
Yeah.
Don't move so fast,
I won't
okay?
Get up
because
too
you
quickly.
Might be a little bit
busy.
Bye.
In the end, the whole process wasn't that big a deal.
Just move slowly, okay?
It was only a couple of days out of my life. People probably spend more time doing their taxes every year. The 43-year-old man received his stem cells. And there's this process set up so that donors and recipients can eventually meet each other. But I don't think I'm up for that. After watching Scott go through his battle with cancer, I just can't handle the heartache.
That was Weekend America producer Mark Sanchez. Interesting fact, Caucasians have about an 88% chance of finding at least one potential match, while African Americans have about a 60% chance.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's basically because blacks and other minorities, they don't get on the registry because there's sometimes a high level of mistrust of medical institutions, sometimes there's language barriers, and also there's misconceptions about what it takes to become a donor.
This is the final weekend of the National Bone Marrow Donor Program's Thanks Mom campaign. It falls in the 2 weeks around Mother's Day. So while you're thanking your mom for giving you life, you can consider giving life to someone else.
Last year, 43,000 new donors joined the registry during that campaign. If you're interested or if you have more questions about bone marrow donation, join Mark at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Can't afford gas? It's time to fix up that bicycle, and we're here to help you, coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. And it's time for your letters. 2 weeks ago, a Weekend America listener named Marianne Wise told us a spring break story. It was 1972. She was 18. She and two girlfriends were hitchhiking to Florida. They had gotten to Calhoun, Georgia, and they were thumbing a ride on I-75 when a state trooper picked them up. That trooper, Lester Rampe, heard about our story, and he contacted us. I asked him what he remembered about that day.
I just remember that I saw the girls on the interstate, and I just stopped and talked to them. And, of course, they told me their story and seemed like pretty nice girls, so knew they didn't need to be out on the interstate late at night. So I made arrangements with the sheriff's office and thought they might have a place for them to sleep. Of course, I guess sympathy-wise, I had kids too, so I assumed that they didn't have a whole lot of money. So the next morning, we fed them breakfast and put them on the entrance ramp. You could hitchhike from the entrance ramp, but you couldn't hitchhike on the interstate itself.
Well, Lester, you wrote into us saying you wanted to get in touch with Marianne. We have her waiting on the other line right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, she doesn't know that you're with us, okay?
Oh,
so
really?
This is going to be a surprise reunion.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, Marianne?
Yes.
Marianne, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we featured your story about hitchhiking to spring break.
Right.
We got tons of letters and comments about that story. People really enjoyed it. And one of the folks who wrote in is on the line with us. His name is retired Major Lester Rampe. He's the Georgia State Trooper who picked you and your friends up.
Oh, my God.
Marianne, meet Lester.
Oh, Lester. What a riot. I can't tell you how many times I've thought about you. And just thank you, you know, mentally for watching over us.
Well, it was a real surprise. I had wondered about that, but it brought back a lot of memories, and I guess I probably hadn't thought of it in years.
Well, you know, we sent you a postcard from Florida, and we often wondered if you ever got the postcard.
Seems like I vaguely remember that.
Okay.
It seems like I do. It's coming back into my little memory bank.
Sure.
When you get 69, I'm 69 now. You don't have as much memory bank as you used to.
Lester, what do you suppose was on your mind as you dropped these three girls off on the interstate on-ramp the next day?
Just probably prayed that they'd make it to Florida, more than likely, because they were going regardless of what I did.
You are so right about that.
What I like about this whole story is how your completely different worlds came together that day.
And I don't know how many breakfasts Lester bought for people that he picked up off the highway before, but to me it just felt so full of care and really just attention that we felt really lucky.
My wife says if I won the lottery that I wouldn't, if it was $100 million, and I wouldn't have but probably $1 million in a year, because I would give it to people I thought needed it.
Lester, it sounds like it was another day for you, but you sure made an impression on three girls from Minnesota, three young women.
I'm proud that they remembered it, and I'm proud that they got to Florida and back to Minnesota and still are doing okay.
We sure are. Yep, we all are. And, you know, I have one photograph remaining from this trip, and if I could pick a photograph to survive all these years, this would be the photograph, and you are in it. And it's just a treasure. My daughter has asked questions about that. You know, what am I doing with those policemen? And it's been the source of a lot of really good stories.
Lester and Marianne, it's been a joy to talk to you both. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for doing that. Just what a surprise.
Well, thank you, too, because I still enjoy old stories like this. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Marianne lives in Wisconsin now, and she invited Lester to come up and visit, and she would buy him some breakfast this time.
Hope he doesn't have to hitch a ride up there. We love hearing from you. Send your comments, letters, and suggestions to us at weekendamerica.org.
We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. Today's Bike Safety Rodeo in Naperville, Illinois, is part of National Bike Month, and it is not just for kids. A lot of grown-ups are taking up bicycling these days to get from here to there without paying $4 a gallon, and also to get some fun and some exercise. So maybe you've been thinking about getting back on that rust-colored thing that's been leaning against the side of your garage for 6 years now. I had a notion that maybe you might want to do that. But it's understandable that you might look at it and just really see the fixing up that you would have to do, and that's daunting. So let us help you. We asked Minneapolis-based bike shop owner Chuck Cowan to give you some tips.
The main thing people should look for is making sure any of the safety features on the bike work, making sure the brakes work. For bikes that have been sitting around a long time, you know, you really got to watch out for dry rot on the tires, especially if they've been sitting in UV rays. They can blow out very easily. Also, bikes that have been sitting out in the weather, cables can get rusty inside, which will make your brakes not work that great. It's something you want to have changed out as soon as possible. Most of the other stuff, you know, you should bring it by a shop and have a general safety check to make sure all the nuts and bolts are tight and that kind of stuff. You know, there's a little maintenance every year you needed to do. The initial cost of a new bike, you know, $500 or so, depending on what you want to spend, what's comfortable for you. The amount of money you're going to save in gas daily and in parking fees, especially if you work in the downtown areas, is going to be substantial. Riding a bike will pay for itself within a year at least. If it's been a while since you've been on a bike, or, you know, say you got your old bike out or you're going to get a new bike first time, some of the things you need to watch out for are inattentive drivers. Most vehicles don't think bikes have any right to be on the road, so be aware of that, but you do. Make sure if you're riding at night, you're plenty visible. Maybe some tires with reflective sidewalls, front and rear lights, maybe a safety vest. You know, you should probably be wearing a helmet. Try to find the bike lanes that are easiest to get you to and from work or to the grocery store. Just be aware of your surroundings as far as traffic, potholes in the road, lights and stop signs at intersections. It's not as hard as it looks. It's very easy. You know, if you've got like anywhere from a mile to a 10-mile commute, you're going to be there before you know it, and you probably won't even break a sweat. Oh, and it's going to be super fun to ride your bike back and forth to work. It's a lot easier than you think it is. You'll feel good at the end of the day, and after a couple of months, you'll be getting to work at half the time than when you started.
Chuck Cowan in his bike shop with the excellent name Behind Bars. This weekend, they're holding their annual Art-A-Whirl sale in honor of an art gallery tour in northeast Minneapolis. So it truly is the art of bicycle maintenance, if you will.
You know, Minneapolis is such a bike-friendly city. Mm-hmm. Unlike my hometown of Detroit, they were named one of the most bicycle-unfriendly cities in America recently. Not enough bike lanes and not enough bike shops. But they're trying to get off the list. There's a group called Detroit Bikes, and it sponsors two-wheel tours of the Motor City. And they say that they want Detroit to become the city that moves the world one pedal at a time.
Well, this is National Bike Month. Bicycling events abound this weekend. So kids and adults, happy pedaling. This is Weekend America.
You're listening to Weekend America. That's the sound of an oud, a 5,000-year-old instrument from Iraq. Now, if you've never seen one, it's pear-shaped, and it looks kind of like a European lute. In fact, the oud is a forerunner of the lute and most other stringed instruments, including the guitar. This weekend, master oud player Rahim Alhaj is performing in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Back in the 80s, Saddam Hussein's regime forbade Rahim from playing his music and threw him in prison twice. In 1991, his mother helped him escape to Jordan, and he eventually settled in New Mexico in 2000. But before crossing into Jordan, Iraqi officials gave him a choice, his freedom or his oud.
I told myself, there is no choice. You have one choice, is to save your life or to save your beloved things, the oud. And I was back and forth, crying between the bus and the border, and I came back to the officer begging him if he could just give it to me. And he refused. And for more than five years, I could not sleep without this instrument. I have to sleep with it. I have to touch it, and I have to cover it and talk to it. And I get just ill in the same minute. How can I leave my oud? I mean, what I will do? And then I made decision is that I have to save my life, and I have to cross the border, and I did that without my instrument.
You wrote a piece about that journey.
Yes, I wrote a piece, actually. It's called Missing. It just betrayed my feeling to my city, Baghdad, and my friends and family, and my mom specifically.
Feel like when you have the oud in your arms and you're playing it?
I feel I'm with my mom, you know, just like a little boy when I'm in her lap, and she hugged me, and always sitting in my mom's lap. The great things about the oud that when you play it, the oud, you have to hug it. You have to put your arm around it, and the back of the oud will touch your chest and your stomach, and it's exactly you are hugging a person, and when you play the oud, it goes directly to your heart.
You went back to Iraq in 2004. Tell me what surprised you most about that trip.
When I went 2004, actually I've been away 13 years. And I was dying to see my family and my friends and my country. And I was just thinking of going there, and I can see my mom again, which is I was just dreaming to see her just one time. She said, Rahim, I have to see you before I will die. And I did a concert in my home where a lot of friends and neighbors and relatives and a lot of people was sitting literally near my feet. And there is no electricity during that time. I mean, still there is no
electricity. There's no electricity.
Yeah, there is no electricity. And I remember looking and playing and looking to my mom's face when she just looked at me, and she's very proud and she's very happy. And it was so emotional and so clear to me, actually. So it was very nice.
Rahim, you're playing this weekend. You've been touring. What do you hope audiences will take away?
I would love from the American audience to understand this instrument is called oud. It's ancient instrument. and belong to all of us. I want them to understand Iraq has a culture and has music. I need them to understand that this is all of us. We are a human being here. We live this globe, and we need to accept each other. I need them to understand that Iraq, so rich country, full of music like any country in the world. So I have this responsibility to keep Iraqi tradition, Iraqi music alive.
Well, thank you for being with us, Rahim.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Rahim Al-Haj will be performing tonight in Santa Fe, and he's touring the U.S. this summer. Or he'll just play for you right now. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
If you're in New Mexico, temperatures in the 80s and 90s aren't much, but in Washington and Oregon in mid-May, they are record highs. With more notes on the weather and the weekend, here's Brendan Noonan.
Cucumbers are the Rolling Stones of the vegetable world. You love them when they're young, but you kind of love them more after they've been besought with pickling agents and exposed to exotic spices. You can celebrate that love at the 17th Annual Pickle Fest in Russellville, Arkansas. It's going to be sunny and 80 degrees, so sympathy for the pickle won't be necessary. Life will grind to a halt this weekend in Welland, Minnesota, for their annual Standstill Parade. This is an event where the parade doesn't move, but the spectators do. The forecast calls for mostly sunny skies and a high of 73. Not surprisingly, the parade is being held at the exact same place it was held last year. Columbia, Maryland is hosting Wine in the Woods this weekend. It's a celebration of wine in the woods. The forecast calls for partly cloudy skies and highs in the mid-70s. You know, I used to go to a festival like this every weekend during my senior year in high school. We called it Beer in the Woods. I'm assuming in this case, the cops will be much, much cooler. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
Hip-hopping old school in the heart of Texas, coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
This is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This is a big weekend for hundreds of thousands of hip-hop fans who will be glued to their computers. Rapper Bun B has posted his entire new solo album, 2 Trill, on his MySpace page. The album is due out on Tuesday. For nearly two decades, Bun B performed with his partner, Pimp C, as the Houston hip-hop group UGK, that's short for Underground Kings. They're one of the longest-running groups in hip-hop history. But one half of the duo, producer Pimp C, died in December. Reporter Michael May talks to surviving partner Bun B on the eve of his solo release.
A couple of months ago, I was fighting my way through the throngs of 20-somethings at Austin's South by Southwest. I figured I'd have no trouble getting in to see the veteran Houston rapper Bun B. He's been making music since the 80s, so by hip-hop standards, he's old news. Instead, I turned the corner and immediately entered the world of the Dirty South. Bass boomed across the pavement from the packed club. At least a dozen people were pressed up against the glass doors. One guy pulled out a roll of 20s and attempted to bribe the doorman. Lesson learned. If you live in Texas and want to see Bun B perform, show up early. Bun B grew up as Bernard Freeman in the small Gulf Coast town of Port Arthur, where blacks and Hispanics live right up against the fence line of oil refineries, which leak toxic fumes and occasionally explode. People here typically end up in one of two places, at the refineries or the local prison, either as guards or inmates. Bernard was a good student. He had ambition. In 1989, in high school, he took on the name Bun B and hooked up with a rapper and producer named Chad Butler, or Pimp C.
Pimp was a lot more boisterous, a lot more flamboyant, a lot more outward. I was more of an introvert, kind of kept to myself, and I was more action, less talk.
Bun says they were a perfect complement when it came to making music. Together, they formed the rap group Underground Kings, or UGK. Bun B even turned down a college scholarship to keep the group together. Folks in Port Arthur thought he was crazy.
I come from a small town, you know what I'm saying? And there were times where we weren't making any money from what we were doing, but we were still trying to move forward. And people didn't understand that, you know, thinking that we could make records that would go gold or platinum and try to get Grammy nominations, people didn't understand that, you know. Talking about Port Arthur and saying that we were going to make Port Arthur into this major thing in America, you know. And at the end of the day, nobody really understood what we were going through but each other.
Pimp C did the production for the group at his parents' house. One day his stepdad told him their music sounded like noise. Typical dad stuff. But then he said something that made an impression on young Pimp. He told him that if he could figure out a way to put some music in it, he'd get rich. So Pimp started producing hip-hop that sounded like a natural extension of soul and blues. One of UGK's first productions updated a classic Rufus and Chaka Khan song. UGK's signature sound was already in full effect. The melodic drawl in the vocals, the relaxed groove. It was hip-hop that made you feel all right. They released their first cassette within a year of graduating high school. It was called The Southern Way, and it sold 50,000 copies within 4 months. It was the beginning of a sound made by and for the people of Texas. In 1991, they signed with Jive Records, then the premier hip-hop label, and they began to fatten their sound with live instruments. Check out the warmth that emanates from this classic song of 1996's Riding Dirty.
Mama put me out at only 14, so I start selling crack cocaine and codeine. Time to stack some paper, I gotta do it quick. Thinking I'm a juvenile, but they don't know who they messing with. Yeah.
That record sold 500,000 copies, despite the fact that Jive Records didn't release a single or make a video. By 2002, UGK seemed poised for stardom. Texas hip-hop was dominating urban radio from coast to coast. But Pimp C was perhaps living a bit too true to the game. He was put in prison for brandishing a gun during a fight.
But initially, the assumption was that my career was going to fall apart. That was an assumption from a lot of people, and at times including myself.
Bun B never had any urge to do a solo record, but Pimp convinced him it was the right thing to do.
Because at the end of the day, it was the best decision for the group to keep the legacy alive, you know, but I didn't want to come to that decision to seem like an opportunist.
Bun B's album Trill went gold, but his loyalty to his friend never waned. He virtually turned the phrase "Free Pimp C" into a rallying cry for Southern hip-hop. So when Pimp finally was freed in 2006, UGK went right back into the studio. Their self-titled 2007 album stayed true to form. It was unabashedly soulful and unapologetically gangster. It debuted at number one on the Billboard charts. It gets no love. She be cross-country giving all that she got. A thousand a pop, I'm pulling Bentleys off the lot. I smashed up the gray one, bought me a red. But in December of last year, Pimp C was found dead in his hotel room. The cause was a combination of sleep apnea and Texas hip-hop's drug of choice, codeine cough syrup. 2 days later, UGK was nominated for a Grammy.
Just as a human being, loss is devastating, especially loss of someone that you've bonded with or someone that you're working very closely with. Loss can definitely be a devastating act. It can break a person very easily.
What do you miss most?
His company. I think it's really that simple. It's not about music or performances or any of that stuff. I just miss his company. I just miss not being able to talk to him.
In Austin, I'm Michael May for Weekend America. Yeah, see, I remember how it all began. I used to slang dirty raps to my PA fans. And back then, I knew you couldn't stop this flow. No other MC around could go like I go. I brought the new style in and the bass, it got crunker. I bought me a stab and now I'm a pop trucker. Do I want to rap or swear? I like that.
Bun B's new album, 2 Trill, hits the stores on Tuesday, and it features a dedication to Pimp C called Angel in the Sky.
Well, that's another crunk-like hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can download a free podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's the weekend. Enjoy it.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
For some veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, old traumas have been buried a long time.
Once I retired, I had too much time on my hands, too much time to think about different things, and I just kept getting deeper and deeper in problems.
On the next Weekend America, troops back from the Middle East are helping older vets deal with traumatic memories of war. Join us.